Camera 142.
All right, let's start. You ready?
Monsignor Higgins.
Ready, Michael? Great.
And rolling.
Camera 142, Monsignor Higgins, RO 67.
Monsignor Higgins, let's start up before talking about the UFW, talking about the fields in the 50s and the Bracero program. What was the effect, what was the relationship between having a Bracero program and whether you could organize farmers?
Well, let me go back a step and say that I knew the Bracero program only from being a member of a commission set up by Secretary of Labor Mitchell. And it was clear as we got into the study of the problem that you would never be able to organize farm workers as long as you had a Bracero program. That was obvious. I give great credit to Mitchell for opening that problem up. And
I think we're gonna stop for a minute. We just lost the lights. We have to get the jinxes out of the room.
Blow a fuse or what?
No, it's
I forget the name of that, but he used to fall asleep in the meetings.
Started with an H or something.
Take two.
My father taught at USC, so I think I know the name. That's cute.
But I was extremely fond of Mitchell. He was, in many ways, the best Secretary of Labor in recent years, I think, because he had a feel for, he got along very well with the labor leaders, even when they criticized him, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember being at one convention where George Meany chewed him out and went back with him to his hotel room, and within 15 minutes, half the executive council was in there having a drink with him. Oh, you know, George, they said, don't take that too seriously.
Well, there is this, what do we used to call it in the union? The Dog and Pony Act, right?
Yeah.
You go through the motions and you say, fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Should we try this again? Okay.
Still three.
Mm-hmm.
Rolling.
Take two.
Monsignor Higgins, let's start over again with what you were saying about the Bracero program and it's stopping organizing.
Well, I said that my knowledge of the Bracero program was from a distance. I served on a three-man commission appointed by Secretary of Labor Jim Mitchell to look into the problem. We finally made a report based on research by his staff and by our trips to the fields. And as I said, I give Mitchell great credit for being the first one in public life to make this an issue that attracted some attention. Unfortunately, we call it, it was not ended under his administration, but finally ended under Bill Wirtz's administration when Bill was Secretary of Labor.
But you were saying that it really was a block to organize, wasn't it?
Oh, of course. It was obvious. You know, once you saw what was happening, there'd be no way you could organize farm workers when they could bring in an unlimited supply of captive labor, as it were, you know.
Mm-hmm. When the farm workers started organizing in Delano in 65, the Protestant denominations came in very early to support. And the Catholic Church has a certain inertia in terms of getting into action. But you finally got involved as a negotiator. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I was not involved at all in 65. I was 3,000 miles away, and I really knew only what I read in the newspapers. But I think it's perfectly true. The Protestants were the first ones in. This is the farm worker ministry, Chris Hartmeyer and his group. I don't know what the attitude of the local bishops was at that time, but by the time I got in, it was around the late 60s, early 70s, it had reached the point where there was an effort made to get the United States bishops to, at their annual meeting, to come out in favor of the boycott, which I strongly supported. Two of the California bishops who were at that meeting said, well, before you make a formal endorsement of the boycott, let us look into the problem, see if there's any way we can mediate this. Meanwhile, the president of the conference had appointed a five-man committee of bishops, and these two men were on it. The chairman was Bishop Donnelly of Connecticut, who had had a lot of experience as the chairman of the Connecticut State Labor Mediation Board, so he knew what he was doing. He called me and said, what's happening out there? Well, I said, as far as I know, nothing. Well, he said, then we're not going to wait. So then he called the first meeting of the entire committee we met in California. And after that, the committee became, in effect, Bishop Donnelly and myself, and then Father Mahoney, now Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles, who was our leg man and made all the arrangements and so forth. And the committee, as a committee, then really didn't function much after that, except through Donnelly.
You did a lot of the work of the committee. What did it feel, I mean, did you really think you could bring these growers and those farm workers together and work something out?
Well, our only hope was to get a contract, and that was Caesar's desperate hope. He had no contracts. So the only role that we were able to play was to go around and talk to the growers, or try to soften them up a bit. And finally, it was agreed that, on the part of some of them, that they would meet with Caesar if we would sit in on the negotiations. Well, I said, and I'm sure Bishop Donnelly said, well, we'll sit in, but we're not going to participate, and it's not our business to negotiate contracts. But if you want us to sit in for color, well, of course, we'll do it, which we did a number of times. And that was the only role we were able to play. Caesar was desperate for a contract. And I think we helped him a little by giving it a certain respectability, you know. It took some of the fear away on the part of some of the growers. And he finally got some contracts. But he wasn't able to move at all before that.
Well, then, but I'm trying to think about what your committee did. You really did create the environment, didn't you?
Well, in the sense that we went around and we met most of the growers informally. Made it very clear that we believed that the workers had a right to organize. We weren't there to kid them, but said we would be fair and try to be helpful. Well, it reached the point where the growers had enough trust in us that they didn't want to meet unless we were there. I remember in one case, my memory is getting very poor, I can't remember the name at the moment, but I was sitting here in Washington minding my own business. I got a call on a Sunday afternoon saying, this grower saying, negotiations are starting tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. I'd like you to be there. Well, I said, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon here. And he, well, I said, there are airplanes, you know. So I got out there. But he didn't want to have a meeting unless we were there. And that was mainly the role we played. We made it very clear, of course, to everybody that where we stood, there was never any doubt about that. But there was enough of respectability attached to it that it made it easier for some of the growers to sit down with them.
Because I've had growers tell me that they felt that the Bishop's Committee was a form of pressure, that you were so obviously on their side.
The growers thought that we were trying to bludgeon them into. Well, that wasn't really true. But they were never any doubt where we stood. But at the same time, they realized that if there was going to be any movement, they didn't want to have any movement without us being there. They wanted some witnesses, so to speak, because they'd had a few experiences, I think, of negotiating with Caesar or maybe with Dolores, where things got out of hand, you know.
Well, I don't know if you have anything to compare it to, because you're not a labor negotiator, but the farm workers had an unorthodox style of negotiating.
They certainly did.
Tell me about that.
Well, I'll give you one example that comes to my mind right now. Dolores would normally bring in a group of rank-and-file workers, sometimes a big group. And she would, of course, periodically call for a recess so she could translate to the workers what was going on. I don't know very much Spanish, but others who were present said that she really wasn't filling them in at all. She was just talking about the weather or something. You know, this was one of her techniques.
Well, this may be a digression, but...
But you drive the growers crazy by bringing these big groups. Very difficult to negotiate when you've got 30 people on one side, you know.
Well, one of the growers said that he thought that Dolores was confrontational and... I'm sorry, what? Oh, I'm sorry, okay. Let's stop for a second. This is going...
Camera roll number 68 starts now. Take number 3 on camera roll number 142.
How are we on this magazine? Okay, yeah, another question,
then
we'll change. Yeah, okay.
Rolling. 3.
The Bishop's Committee started off as this providing this setting so that the growers would feel comfortable talking to the farm workers, but later on, you provided a setting where two unions talked to each other. That was different, wasn't it?
Well, with the fight between the Teamsters and the UFW, that was a very interesting period or episode in our negotiations. Frank Fitzsimmons was the president of the Teamsters. I knew him, of course, here in Washington. We had a number of shouting matches with Fitz here in Washington. But finally, as you know, an agreement was made that the Teamsters would get out of their contracts, the sweetheart contracts they had signed. So I was, in effect, made the intermediary to make sure that this thing kept on track. It was a very, very interesting period. Fortunately, even though we had bloody fights with the Teamsters, we remained friends because Fitz was a friend of mine, and he was not the type of fellow who would walk away from you. But as it turned out, that initial agreement didn't work out well, as you know. It just collapsed. But we played a role in that. I did personally as the one who was supposed to make sure that it stayed on track.
And you told me that Fitzsimmons said he couldn't work with Caesar because he was violent.
Well, at one point, Fitzsimmons called a meeting of his regional satraps, sort of an executive off-the-record meeting, and invited Bishop Donnelly and myself and Father Mahoney, the Monsignor Mahoney, to sit in on it. So we sat up on the stage or in the podium with Fitz. The others were down in the crowd. And at one point, Fitz got a little carried away and said that couldn't work with the farm workers because they were violent. They went in for violence. Well, I found that very amusing, and I couldn't resist saying this to Fitz, so I think he was very angry, that I said, I understand that Caesar believes in nonviolence. He's a Gandhi follower. I said, I am not. I don't believe in nonviolence. I said, I've always admired the Teamsters for their selective violence, and I'm embarrassed to see you walking away from this. Well, he didn't like that, of course.
But was it a different... When you negotiated between the two unions, was that a different feeling, or the issues were different, weren't they, in terms of what you had to get done?
Oh, yeah. We never negotiated with the growers at all. Yeah. We were just observers. But with Fitz, we were determined to help Caesar carry that fight through, because what the Teamster did was intolerable, signing these sweetheart contracts. We never made any secret of that with the Teamsters. As I said, we had a number of meetings here in Washington, and then George Meany got involved. He appointed Joe Keenan, who's now deceased, and Paul Hall of the Seafarers, who was deceased. They came out to California to try to act as an intermediary. And
the Seafarers brought some muscle out too, didn't they?
Well, they did at one point, and when we were meeting in Salinas.
Okay, let's stop for a second. Now we're in a film change. I remember. I guess it was Marshall.
Camera 143 starts now. Take 4.
Rolling.
Camera 143, sound 68.
We were just talking about trying to work the situation out with the Teamsters in Salinas, but 3 years later in Coachella, it came back, and it was even worse then, wasn't it? Wasn't that the biggest confrontation?
Yeah, well, that when the Teamsters brought the goons in, they never bothered us. We were out in the picket on all the time. They never made any threats against us, but as you know, they beat up on another priest who happened to be involved. He was having lunch in a restaurant with the Wall Street Journal correspondent, and they knocked his teeth out. But there was never any threat of physical violence against us. If there had been, that would have been very interesting, because I would have gone right to the top on that.
There's a piece of film from Fighting for Our Lives where you and Caesar are at a press conference in Coachella, and Caesar's talking about the incidents, and he's talking about how happy he is that the farm workers have been able to keep that spirit of nonviolence. Was that how were they able to do that?
Well, that was one of Caesar's great contributions. He did manage to keep them nonviolent. He did it initially by the fast, you know. The first fast was to, for the benefit of the workers, to keep them nonviolent. No, I never saw any violence on the part of the farm workers. There might have been a little now and then, but I never saw any.
But that moment in 73 in Coachella, that felt like war in the field.
Well, yeah, you'd go out on these lonely roads out in the fields, and you'd see nothing but these big goons from Los Angeles there. But I never saw any actual violence on the picket line. Mm-hmm. There might have been some, but there was violence against the priest in the restaurant, of course. Mm-hmm.
We were talking earlier on about there never was any doubt where you were in the matter, that you believed in people's right to organize, and that's why you were there. Talk a little bit about how you feel the church in general operated and how you felt what the right role for the church should be in a situation like that.
Well, I prejudiced, of course. I think our bishops' committee played the proper role. We might have made mistakes here and there, but in general, I think we played the proper role. It was, we were pro-union, but neutral as between themselves and the Gores. We never got involved in trying to work out the terms of the negotiations. Secondly, I think that, and here I'm prejudiced also because of my own experience and my own attitudes, I never felt that we should be completely beholden to Caesar. If we weren't working for the farm workers, we were our own people, we had to have our own independent thinking, and I think that some of the clergymen, including some priests, and some of the Protestant people involved, went too far in just kind of letting Caesar tell them what to do on every point. I just wouldn't do that, and I think Caesar knew that I wouldn't. He never asked me to, but I wouldn't have done it anyhow. I didn't think that was our role.
Well, but there was a situation.
We were not working for the farm workers. We were working for ourselves and for our own organization.
But one of these situations we were talking about was that you were given a choice, for example, when Caesar went to the Philippines and there was a problem in the Philippines.
Well,
Where was the church on that?
When Caesar went to the Philippines, the Washington Post had a stringer in Manila. It became a front page story. I couldn't believe it when I read it, that Caesar had come out in favor of martial law. I just couldn't believe it. So I got a member of our staff who was an expert on the Philippines, and I said, get me a bushel basket full of material on the Philippines. I sent it out to Caesar immediately, and I said, Caesar, this is none of my business, but if this story is true, you're in trouble. And I can only suggest that you get out of it as fast as you can. I never heard from him. In all the years I knew him, he never mentioned it. But then some years later, there was so much criticism of his involvement in the Philippines, mainly from Protestant groups, missionary groups, that he decided to have a meeting in the public school in Delano, which was supposed to pacify the parties, but it had the opposite effect. When I got there, there were pickets outside on both sides, anti-Marcos and pro-Marcos. We get in the hall, and Caesar was on the stage with two or three people from the Philippines who were trade union leaders, so-called, but as far as I knew, they were Marcos people. And I was asked to come up and sit on the stage. I said, no way will I sit on the stage with those people. I said, I'm opposed to what they're doing. And I said, I not only want to sit on the stage, I'll probably have something to say from the down here in the hall, which I did later on. Well, then at the end of the meeting, which was a complete circus, it accomplished nothing except to cause more trouble, Caesar had a dinner at a local Mexican restaurant in honor of these visitors, and he wanted me to come. He sent Chris Hartmar to ask me to come, so I said, well, I'll come, but I won't sit with them because I don't agree with them. I think, you know, martial law is a bad thing. These people represent martial law. So we had the dinner, and it was an uneventful dinner except for an unpleasant conversation I had with Chris about my attitude on being independent of Caesar, and there was no way that I was going to agree with him when I disagreed with him.
Let's stop for a minute. Did you come out when Caesar did his last fast in 1988?
I did.
Fast for life.
Yes.
Do you have strong memories of that?
Oh, very much so. I came out with...
Five.
Rolling. Two.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about what you thought about...
Well, from the little I heard and read about it, I was afraid he might die on that strike.
Could we start over again? Because I was... Start over again.
Well, we were talking about Caesar's last fast. I went out for the ending of the fast with three or four labor leaders from Washington. We went out together on the plane. They wanted to show their colors, and I went with them. And Caesar, of course, was very weak that day, but he came out of it. But everything I read scared me. I thought that maybe this time he had gone over the hump, you know, and that he might not pull back, but he did, and within a few months he seemed to be back to normal again.
That fast was sort of the end of a long campaign that involved a boycott, working on pesticide issues.
And yes.
What was your general impression of the way they were trying to operate in the 80s? Was it working?
Well, I think the answer will vary with the people you ask it of. My own feeling was that it was time to not to give up on boycotts, but to ease up a bit and get back to normal organizing. I never thought that you could keep this boycott alive forever, and particularly when they went into the high-tech boycott.
You want to stop until this is over? Are you okay? Okay, let's if you're still, are you still on?
Yeah, but the door is, the door.
Shut the door, shut the door. Thank you. Okay, we're still rolling.
I stayed out of it because it's none of my business to be giving advice to Caesar. But my own personal view was that the high-tech boycott was not going to work, that it was a charade in a certain sense. They didn't believe that, of course. They were very critical of me when I suggested it to them in conversations. But I always had the feeling that that was not going to solve the problem, that they'd have to get back to normal, regular organizing, which I think they're doing now. And I think with some effect. But people can get mesmerized by the boycotts. The first one was successful, but it was an easy thing to do because most of the people who were getting publicity for being on the boycott never ate grapes anyhow, except out of a bottle. And they'd like to enjoyed having these nice parties on Park Avenue to raise money for Caesar. It was a nice thing to do. Didn't cost anybody very much sweat, you know. And it was very popular. Well, that was good. I think it had an effect. But you can't keep that up forever, at least in my view. But it was none of my business to tell Caesar that, although I did tell it to Dolores and Artie at one time, a few years ago, and they were not happy with what I said, but I said it.
Well, let's switch gears for a little bit. There were some things that didn't work, but there were a lot of things that the farm workers and Caesar did that did work, and there was a certain strength to it. Talk about what you think they did that really worked and why it worked.
Well, first of all, I'd say that Caesar was undoubtedly a genius. Nobody else in American history had done or could have done what Caesar did. And part of it was the boycott. Part of it was his genius at organizing. I think the main thing he did was to establish a union, to get a basic union established and get some grievance procedures built into it. Health insurance, etc. So it was a great, great contribution. And I think he will go down as one of the truly great figures in the history of the American labor movement. But I was a long distance from their day-to-day operations, so I don't know exactly how it worked out in practice, but there's no doubt that no one else could have done what he did. That's why I'm always amused when his critics on the loony side say that that he got into the movement because of Saul Alinsky. And Saul Alinsky was a communist, and of course, no communist party would ever tolerate Saul Alinsky in its ranks, you know, no way. And secondly, Saul tried to talk him out of starting a union, as I recall it, but Caesar had enough intuition to say the way to go is to a union. But if he hadn't done that, there wouldn't be a farm workers' union today.
But what characterized the Farm Workers Union was that it wasn't a traditional union. It
No.
was something else.
It was a movement. It was ethnic. It was religious. It was labor. It was everything mixed up. I remember we never had a rally in the Coachella Valley without having a mass, you know, out in the park in the evening. And on one occasion, Joe Keenan, representing George Meany, and Paul Hall, representing George Meany, were in the audience. Keenan was an Irish Catholic from Chicago who had never seen a mass like that in his life, you know. Paul Hall was a Baptist from Mississippi who was sitting in the back of the crowd smoking a cigar. So when we broke up, we went into somebody's motel room to talk about the Teamster problem, and I said, Paul, what did you think of that religious service day? He said, the best damn organizing meeting I've ever been to in my life, he said. So they were able to combine. There were kids running all over the altar. There were dogs all over the place. But it was part of the culture, and they couldn't have done it without that.
It was integral, right?
It mystified many of the traditional labor leaders. They'd never seen anything like this, you know. It was one of the reasons, I think, that it took George Meany a while to appreciate Caesar. This was not the way you organized in New York City, you know, with the plumbers.
Okay, we're going to change film on this. We're going very well. We're almost done. This is very good stuff. Up to the church to decide. It's not our...
Camera 144 starts now. 144 starts now. It'll be take one when it's up.